Welcome to Threshold Stories, crossing thresholds one story at a time. I'm your host, Jeff Gora. Hello, everybody. This is podcast 113, first of two, about working with refugees and participating in a world championships. I probably need to start with a timeline for this because the temptation is to draw some sort of conclusion that doesn't associate with the timeline. So let me do that. So each year, if you qualify for a world championship from your respective country, you have to travel to a country to compete, and that rotates from location to location. So the country that hosts has to competitively bid, and they say, here's why you need to select us as the host city, no different than the Olympics. In fact, the Olympics gets their model from them. And for 2021, at the end of 2021, as you can see from this picture here, Turgu Mureş is what it's called, but I'll just call it TM for short here. TM was selected to be the host for the world championships in some of the disciplines that I do. Well, they'd already hosted the European championships in 2019, and it was natural for them to be selected to host the whole world championships for 2022. The original locations for these things has rotated. Perhaps it used to be Australia should have been the host. Australia had lockdowns that went on during COVID, and they could no longer host it. The U.S. made a bid to host it. Components of it, the Australia one, were shifted to the Netherlands, and the Netherlands hosted components of it, but they couldn't host all of it. So part of that got shifted from the Netherlands to Spain, so it ended up getting split between a couple of different countries. I didn't think anything of anything, really, when I heard Romania was going. I'd never been to Romania. I had a college roommate who immigrated from Romania, but that was in 1986, I believe, is when he lived with us, 1985, 86. So it had been quite a long time. And I figured, let's go to this town. I'd never been here. And I bought my plane tickets and I began my planning. So the war breaks out in the Ukraine happened. You know, it first gets published in late February, but the hardcore fighting that has been occupying our news and what have you, you know, started in March. So as I found out of this, and I listened to media reports of refugee crises of people fleeing the Ukraine, looking to get out of the line of fire of Russian bullets. I heard that Romania was one of the largest takers of refugees. I thought it was fascinating, you know, that Poland being number one made sense. Big border, close to where the large cities are. Number two, as far as places refugees are going, is Russia. People are leaving the country they're in and going into the country of Russia, even though that's the country that claims it's attacking. That's the number two destination for Ukrainian refugees, even today when I'm recording this in mid-June. But Romania made the list. They had over 500,000 people who would claim Ukrainian heritage who had crossed the border from Ukraine into Romania since the start of the war. So I consider that a big number. So I started asking questions, not that I knew what I was going to do when I got answers to them, but I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I am a Peace Corps volunteer, and I know how to help communities where I don't understand the culture who happen to be in need. I've been trained, I guess is the right answer, to explain why I wanted to do this. So I discovered that there was a refugee community in TM, but it was a split refugee community that I was introduced to. Now, there could be bigger than this, but what I know of is there was a boys water polo team who came over for an event who were stuck. And then there were 37 other families that were in a government-owned hotel in the heart of TM, in downtown TM. So let me back into the geography timeline stuff here using this picture of the Romania. So you can see Ukraine is the northern border. Hungary is, of course, a large border right there, and Moldova is there. But the Ukraine comes in again below Moldova. Romania is not a huge country. It's smaller than Texas, and it has a coastline, so they have some port cities as well. And TM, as you can see, it's right above the RO in Romania, is famous because that's in the province of Transylvania, which is, of course, where Dracula is from. And the Carpathian Mountains are also famous, and they're a part of the country as well. It's called Romania because during the Roman Empire, the Emperor of Rome sent in several legions of troops and killed every native in one specific valley, and it became like the Wild West of the Roman Empire, and a lot of Italians migrated out of the metropolitan Rome area and went to live in Romania because they were getting free land, and it was an agricultural paradise. It's still an agricultural paradise. But most of the population now non-native Romanian roots, since many of those, if not all of those in some places, were killed. So I landed in the little town of Cluj. I took a bus ride from Cluj to TM, and the bus driver was one of the, or the taxi driver, I guess, was one of the people whom I'd met in advance who helped introduce me to some of the community who were assisting the Ukrainian refugees. So keep in mind, here's my mount. This is the little section here is Ukraine, and here is Ukraine. Most of the people whom I dealt with either came over on a public bus or drove their cars. So these weren't the visions you see on National Geographic of people walking barefoot and destitute and holding on to each other for their dear lives. In fact, I'll show you a picture. There's a Beamer in the parking lot of the refugee camp, and it's pretty new, and it has Ukrainian plates on it because the person who came over drove over in their Beamer. When I learned about the refugees being in two distinct locations, I decided I was going to have two different sorts of refugee experiences when I was there. The first one was a boys' sports team that had been stuck in the country since March when they came over for a tournament. So here's a picture on the screen of me and a little boy who is one of the water polo kids, but he's also a refugee. And the area behind me is his dining hall. So it's pretty nice looking, but they have nice tables and chairs and a clean floor, silverware. He's not living what you'd experience in a traditional refugee camp elsewhere. And the two guys on each side of me here, those are the two water polo coaches. The guy to my right, which in your picture looks on the left, his name is Sergey. Sergey was able to come over with his wife and his daughter and his son. His son was already on the water polo team, so it was a natural extension. The older fella to my left, but your right, he has coached and participated in water polo most of his life, and he's a former national champion for Romania. So he knows his stuff inside and out. And from what I can tell, he was not only just mentoring the boys, but he was also mentoring the other coach. And so when that whole group came over there, and they got landlocked, I knew they were going to have their own micro community that they were going to form. So water polo is no different than traveling baseball or traveling soccer. You know, families go out of town, coaches go out of town for a tournament, and they come back afterwards, and the kids resume life Monday to Friday like they do at school. So not much different than in our country. Well, they didn't, when they left for a long weekend in TM, they didn't bring, you know, adequate clothing. It was the winter time when they came over. So I knew the kids would gravitate towards, you know, wanting some of the stuff that we had. So when I talked with the people in advance of what I wanted to do, I told them, I'm going to give all of the kids shirts that have both the Ukrainian flag and the flag of the United States on it, because I thought that would be something fun to do. And I got permission to include the children at the Parade of Nations for the World Championship so they could walk in the USA contingency with us. So if anybody's seen the Olympics, you know what a Parade of Nations is. It's the start of an international event. And the Olympics is, you know, the most pomp and circumstances, but the circumstance actually is identical, as is the culture, where each nation has a flag bearer, and they walk through and they're introduced, and people clap, and athletes meet each other, and everybody's taking pictures. It's the same event. Ours was outside. Ours took place in a medieval castle. It didn't have, you know, every country in the world there. It had a lot of countries, and I don't know what the count was. But it's the same idea. And I had the kids from the water polo team, I wanted to have the kids from the water polo team walk with us in the Parade of Nations. All right, so what did I do before we went? So I started a GoFundMe campaign because I knew I was going to need some cash while I was there. That's always true when you do mission sorts of works. But I also got some donations before I left. So look at this picture here. This is a picture of the back of our van before I drove to go to the airport. So USA Triathlon, I reached out to them, and they donated to me some of their leftover gear from championship events they've had over the years. So they sent me 400 or so, you know, shoulder bags and a couple hundred t-shirts, 200 t-shirts, I believe. Well, if there's 37 families and 22 water polo boys who are landlocked, I said, I'm not going to make use of 400 bags. People can carry one, maybe two at a time max. People don't have shoulder bag inventories. It's not like shoes or something like that. So I only took a portion of those with me to give away. But I did bring all the shirts. I felt that there's a chance water might be a commodity they don't have access to, and they won't be able to wash clothing perhaps as much as I thought. I didn't know, I hadn't been there. But people typically do have inventories of shirts. And I thought 200 shirts, Yeah, everybody can take a shirt or two. That's a good idea. And then I also had a friend of mine who is a Ukrainian descendant. He's, I don't know if it's two generations or three generations removed from leaving the Ukraine and beginning the process of migrating and ending up in North Carolina, United States. But he brought over a box full of lightly worn clothing and some bags as well. I couldn't use all of them, and asked me to take that over with him. And I said, sure, no problem. So I loaded up our van, and all I had was my one bag of stuff that I needed. I decided to rent a bicycle for the World Championships instead of bringing my own. I didn't want to take that risk. And I knew that meant I was going to have a worse outcome than I might otherwise have. But I don't consider that a loss, considering what I was out to do. And, of course, I put my national team uniform up there that I'd earned as well, just kind of to make the picture have a little bit more value to it. So when we land in the airport, I was fortunate enough to have rested, but the driver who picked us up, we had agreed that he was going to take us immediately to the refugee camp, jet lag be damned. So we're eight time zones removed, and he drives us from where he picked us up to the camp outside of the town in TM. So I tucked this picture just out of the front because I was, you know, being Boy Scout 101, asking questions, and I says, where does this road go? And he says, well, it's under construction. It's not done yet. But it's supposed to go all the way to Mariupol. And I was like, oh, Mariupol. I heard about that. I've seen pictures of Mariupol. That city was destroyed by the Russians. He goes, yeah, that the construction on the road is stopped too for that reason. So I just, you know, went to Wikipedia. That works internationally, by the way. And I typed in Mariupol, and I thought, how big is it? It's almost a half a million people, 400 and some thousand and change in the area. And that's gone. That city doesn't exist anymore. I mean, it's just blown up buildings. There's, you know, no electricity, no running water, no usable roads to drive through. All the highways in and out are whoosh. I'm thinking, wow, half a million people. That's a lot. I hadn't really pondered that size because the media doesn't talk about things in those terms. But when you're on a road and the end of the road happens to be Mariupol, those kinds of ideas cross your mind. So everybody in this picture was in the van group with us who went to go work with the water polo team. You can see some of us have on the T-shirts that we wanted, well, we did give to the kids who we met there and some of the adults as well. And, of course, we wanted to play games with them and dance and sing and stuff like that. We definitely got to play some games. I don't think any of us did any dancing. And the only people who did singing were the kids. But Christian, the guy in the back, he was our driver. Deepak's kind of like our travel agent for Team USA. He's the Indian-looking guy. Actually, he's from Kuwait, but everybody calls him the Indian-looking guy who's standing next to me. Kimmy, who plays a big role here in today's events, she's there. Her shirt just says Team USA. And then Jordan, who's an athlete I coach. And then the two girls, Mindy and Aaron, both got on the podium at the World Championships. Oh, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, those two are good, just for the record. So that was the contingent who went to go work with the water polo kids when we got there. So when we arrived, of course, we did our introductions and we handed out some stuff to each of the kids. They, of course, being who they were strong, proud people. They didn't have much interest at all in taking any of the money I thought that they might find a value of, because there wasn't really a way for them to spend it. One of the things I learned when I was there was that the kids had to return to the Ukraine. Otherwise, they risked failing school for the year. And I thought, what do you mean by that? And he says, well, they have a required final exam. And I said, okay, our culture has that too. And there's no mechanism to have them take the test remotely. And I thought, okay, sometimes that happens as well. COVID changed that for much of the world, but I understood that. And they said, so you have to be in the country in order to take the exam. And I thought, well, that's a head scratcher. You've got millions of refugees in Poland, in Russia, in Hungary, in Romania, a lot of towns where everything's blown up. How do they take the exam? Well, the short answer was that doesn't matter. You've got to take the exam or you're going to fail the year. So the next day, we arrived on a Friday. We got there Friday afternoon-ish. The next day, at 8 in the morning, the boys loaded a bus and were leaving to go back across the border into the Ukraine to take final exams. And as Sergei told me later, he said, yeah, we're not going to be able to stay. We're going to have to turn around and come back. So they had to sneak across the border for 12-year-old boys to take some final exams or they were going to fail for the year. So anybody who complains about U.S. policy and protocol for standardized testing, you can just take that idea and put it where the sun don't shine. You don't know what you're talking about compared to some of the other places in the world. All right, I'm going to put this picture up on the screen. I would encourage you to zoom in it a little bit. One of the things that occurs at most refugee camps is places for people to express themselves and mourn and weep and try to experience the steps that everybody goes through when they have loss. And so with most of these being 12-year-old boys, loss for them is much different than for an adult, right? So who they don't have access to is the only family pretty much they've ever known. So it wasn't a husband or wife who you met after you'd already been living 10 or 20 years, or hopefully 20 years. So I thought this was interesting enough to take a couple of pictures of, and I have three pictures like this. So this was drawn by the kid in the blue shirt who you saw earlier. At least I told it was drawn by him. It shows a Russian tank, and it's shooting at a school in the distance. And you can see the people falling out of the school, and there's somebody on the ground holding a big gun and pointing it at the school as well. And then there's a Russian helicopter flying above the school as well, looking for more people to shoot. And that's what the kid has as his memories of home. So I thought to myself, the war broke out kind of sort of after you got here. Now, granted, it started on February 25th, according to the video graphic, but I was wondering, and I don't have the answer to it, I was just speculating, how did the kid get the imagery of his school being shot like this if he's here? And I thought, well, it has to be social media. There had to have been kids in the Ukraine TikToking or whatever and sending out video footage of what was happening at school during the day, and that's all now that he has to build his memory on. So that leads to an entire fascinating conversation about how should freedom of speech be applied for children when they're being exposed to violence care of social media. Was it okay that he saw that this was going on at school and it now became a trauma to him with no one to deal with other than a stranger working in an art room? I don't have a good answer for that, but it certainly makes me ask the questions. All right, that's going to be the end of podcast one. I'm going to do podcast number two. Thanks for listening to this chapter of Threshold Stories, Crossing Thresholds, One Story at a Time. Ready to cross more thresholds with me in 2 weeks. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me directly. You can find me on LinkedIn or on my Facebook page at Jeff Gora Team USA.